Encore with Claire O'Brien, arts and entertainment for the Midlands. With Padder's Bar, In Moat, Gertie Brown's Bar and Bistro, Athlone, and the Cellar Bistro, Strand Street, Athlone.
Well, I am really sorry now to have to take you out of your flashbacks and memories of Sally and homing away and eating your tea and doing your homework at 6:30 every evening after school to bring you Encore this evening. You're very welcome to the programme. It's Claire O'Brien here, as I am every Thursday night between 7 and 8 o'clock, bringing you the best of what's happening in the arts in Laois, Offaly and Westmeath. She is a vixen, but she is also Sister Assumpta on Father Ted. Rose Henderson is on stage at Dunham Ace on the 14th of May in Helen Casey's play Vixen. It is the story of the other woman after the affair, and it is part of the Bealtaine Festival, which kicked off yesterday. Andrew Hughes is the author of One Dublin, one book, that fabulous book, The Coroner's Daughter, and he has recently released a much more contemporary novel. It's called Emma Disappeared, and it's set in modern times in Dublin. And he will tell us about diving into the archives. He had a most fascinating job as an archivist, and how he can make the present day come alive, very much past and present. And Felt. Look around the fields at the moment at the ewes and the lambs, and have you ever wondered what happens to the wool? Well, some of it, but a very tiny amount, is made into felt. And earlier this spring, a new book was published about wool and felt in Ireland, and one of the authors will tell us about just how special Irish felt is and how we can have more of it, and indeed how you can make it yourself. And that is all to come on the programme this evening. But before we get to all of that, next Tuesday sees the first of the Eurovision semi-finals. It's happening in Malmo in Sweden, and Mick Lynch will be with us on the programme next week for the rundown ahead of the final, and hopefully, or not hopefully, depending on whether you're on the side of Mary Coughlan and others who feel that Ireland shouldn't be participating in the Eurovision, Bambi Thug will make it ahead to that final. And in order to do that, they will have to be one of the 10 winners in the first semi-final. There are 15 performers on Tuesday, and Ireland has to be in the top 10. The signs are good at the moment, but you never know, those things can change. The song, you might recall when it was originally chosen, we couldn't play it for you because just, you know, issues around language. But you're going to hear it now, and it isn't the official version that will be performed next week. Or indeed, it's not the official version that will be performed in the final. But it's been described as a crooner. It's a much more easy listening version. I saw it somewhere described as more Barbara Streisand than Nine Inch Nails. I actually think it's quite nice. It's also a lot more radio friendly. It's over a minute longer than the other version, the one that will be performed next week. But your impressions and indeed your Eurovision hopes, we'd love to hear them here on Encore. 083 30 10 103 is the Lamb Brothers Midlands 103 text line. Tell us what you think of either version, or indeed if there's a song that you're really getting behind this year for the Eurovision, drop us a line. Now, a few little things that are happening in the arts locally for you. Well, the Dreamings, the two-night run of that musical, you might remember we had the director in studio with us a few weeks ago. It's a very special musical, a musical theatre experience. There's some community involvement as well, only on two nights. That's tonight and tomorrow night in Mullingar. We wish them the very, very best of luck. Sharon Shannon is in the Dunham Ace Theatre tomorrow night, but really, the big excitement for the Midlands is happening in Athlone this evening, because the final of the All-Ireland Drama Festival gets underway this evening. Let me tell you who has made it through to the final. And there are quite a few familiar names from previous finals. You won't be surprised to hear some of these. Tonight, Bridge Drama, Bring the Wake by Tom Murphy. Tomorrow night, that's the third, Wexford Drama Group, How I Learned to Drive by Paula Vogel. Saturday, Ballyduff Drama Group, The Ferryman by Jez Butterworth. Prosperous Drama, Dramatic Society on Sunday, A View from the Bridge by Arthur Miller. Clontarf Players on Monday night bring Radium Girls by D.W. Gregory. On Tuesday, Dawkey Players take The Crucible by Arthur Miller. Leaving Cert students around the country. Take note, Wednesday the 8th of May, Newpoint Players are in the Shadow of the Glen, reimagined. It's written by Sean Trainer after J.M. Singh, so that'll be interesting. Thursday the 9th, Ballycogley Players, Out of Order by Ray Cooney, and Ballyshannon Drama on Friday the 10th present Margaret by Sean Byrne. I doubt that there are any tickets left, but you can always chance your arm at the Dean Crow Theatre and see if there's anything there that might become available. There might be a return. But if you can't get to the festival itself, there are lots of other things happening. Remember, the Festival Fringe is huge in Athlone. It's grown and grown and grown over the last number of years, and all the events are on dramafestival.ie. But lots of free exhibitions happening between now, they started yesterday, and the end of the festival. So have a look at that dramafestival.ie website and see what is happening. There's so much going on. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, it is to hear from Rose Henderson, who is the actor who played the role of Sister Assumpta on Father Ted. But she's a phenomenal actress, a really terrific performer. But she'll be chatting to us about a role that she is bringing to the stage for the Bealtaine Festival of a woman whose lover has died, a man who was married. That's to come after the break here on Encore on Midlands 103.
Encore with Gertie Brown's Bar and Bistro, an award-winning gastropub in the heart of Athlone with live music and high-quality bar food served daily. Find Gertie Brown's on Facebook and Instagram. Midlands
103. Still to come on the programme, Andrew Hughes talks about his new novel, contemporary this time. It's called Emma Disappeared. The Bealtaine Festival is underway and events are happening and will happen all month, and often, indeed, ideally, specifically to focus on characters and an audience and artists who are over 50. Now, last week we spoke on the programme to Helen Casey, who is the author of Vixen. And tonight we'll hear from Rose Henderson, who plays the character of Vixen in this one-woman show. And her character is not in the first flush of youth, but her married lover has recently died. When I spoke to Rose recently, I asked her to tell me about the character.
Well, Vixen is coming to the Dunamase Arts Centre on the Tuesday, the May the 14th at 8 o'clock. And Vixen, she's a woman who's had an affair with a married man. And she fully expects him to leave the man and the woman and her child because he loves her. And unfortunately, this has been going on for a good few years, but what happens to him is he's a mountain climber and he ups and dies.
That was thoughtless of him.
Right at the beginning of the play, we find her a year later after he has died, and she's absolutely decided that this is the last day. She's not going to visit his grave anymore. She's mourned all on her own because it was a big secret. And she's a lovely, like, she's a very beguiling character because she attracted him. They had a gorgeous relationship, but she always had to wait for him to arrive. She was never sure when he'd come or when he'd go. She had a holiday with him once, but really, you know, they went on a swim together, you know, so she remembers gorgeous moments that they had, but she was never in control. She always had to wait for him. And she felt it was worth it, and she thought he would leave, you know, and be hers. But she doesn't even find out he's dead until well after the funeral. And so here she is trying to, you know, she's an intelligent woman. She knows she's let herself be sucked into this relationship. But it was so gorgeous that she just felt at the time that it was worth it. So it's really interesting. And Helen Casey has written it, and it's a very beautiful piece of writing. So the challenge for me was to make this beautiful poetry sound as if I'm thinking of it at the time.
Yeah.
I
was just going to say that her journey, the way you describe it there, sounds so painful. But the title of the play suggests a little bit of judgment there.
Well, she's gone out, she's held on to him. And she does talk about, like, a man having an affair. We kind of expect men to have affairs, you know, men do. But this is very different because it's the other woman now talking. It's from her point of view. And, like, is she expected to know more than he? And like, you know, he's just had an affair, but when she has an affair, that's a very different matter because she's much more knowing. She knows what she's breaking up, but surely he does too.
Yeah.
So it's very clever. And there's a beautiful moment. There's another reason for the vixen. It's like Helen says, it's like a line of thoughts. So the stuffed fox is lining up like a line of thoughts. And she remembers this time in her childhood where her dad used to bring her off to this fox sanctuary. And she remembers this moment where she waited up into the middle of the night till it got dark enough. And she went out and saw all these foxes standing stock still. And she just remembers that moment. It's really clear to her. So there's another reason that I won't tell you about.
Of course.
This moment is so important that she remembers from her childhood. But it's so she has her remembering things. She has her rewriting things. So, for example, Angie in the play, The Vixen, imagines this fabulous moment where she will embrace the wife. And that the two of them will share the loss that they had between them. And she has this thinking to herself that this will bring closure. That, you know, surely the other woman would understand because they both loved the same man. You know, so some of the time she's making it up, it never happened at all.
Yeah.
And she completely brings the audiences through this moment and she's telling them that it happened, you know. So it's very clever. So as we trawled through the play, Caroline Fitzgerald directs.
Yeah.
And she really, like, we spent a lot of the time in the text going, so did that happen? I don't think that actually happened. And did this happen? Well, that absolutely happened. So it's very interesting because the audience are led along and then let down and then led along and then, oh, no, that did happen. So it's the way we tell a story.
Yeah.
We rewrite the past to make it better, to make ourselves come out of it better.
Yeah. And isn't it, Angie, that seems to be the way that she is managing her grief is by creating a new story and imagining in glorious Technicolor the things that she would like to happen, but that can't possibly happen because he's gone now.
She literally closed herself off from her friends. She teaches. She's an art teacher in the school, so she's bright. But she's shut everybody else out. So she's really no one to talk about him too, because it was a secret. So she's really telling the story to herself where she is in her apartment. And she's very free to be. And Caroline, again, has let me be very, just let me move and let me just find that kind of sexuality in myself. Because what did attract him to her?
Yeah.
You know, if she was so isolated, like, you know, she was available. But what they had was something very, very fresh and very, you know, and they laughed together and they had fun. And I suppose he had the freedom where he didn't have to get the shopping or decide where they were going to eat or, you know, do the washing.
The other thing about Angie is she's supposed to be invisible at that age of her life. She's not supposed to be
isn't that
a
great?
Sexual
and this is
being
the ultimate tour. So yeah. This has been funded. Our tour has been funded by Gansen. So why not? Like, she's a sexual being at this age. So that's wonderful as well. There's no need. Like, she absolutely doesn't feel any need to hide that or to feel any different than a young 20 would. You know, so that's gorgeous. And I think that it's nearly not mentioned, her age.
Yeah.
It's just you could see her age because you're looking at me. But it's, you know, it's wonderful in that this is just... Her feelings are exactly the same as they would have been when she was younger.
Which is so unusual because we're used to the idea that the love stories belong to young people and that older women in stories, and by older I mean anything over 45, that anybody over 45 is a mother or is a daughter who's struggling with parents who are in a difficult situation. But rarely as individuals with dreams and hopes and yearnings and stories of their own.
Yeah. So it's great. And that's what it's. And yet it's very, you know, I've had friends who came to it who said I was well prepared to hate her. Because if she came and did that to my man, I tell you, I'd have the knives out. But by the end of the play, I only felt sorry for her, you know, or I felt actually I could see the courage in her that she was still holding to this and just being herself in those 2 hours that she had occasionally, you know, and that she does say that it's better to have loved and lost, you know, than never to have loved. So at least she had those wonderful times and she had something that was magnificent and she felt fabulous when she was with him.
Yeah.
So that does sustain her.
Yeah. And I imagine it must sustain you as the actor, because as I said, that title seems kind of judgmental, but you as the actor have to find your way into what makes her relatable and real and sympathetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she's no remorse. She's not a bit sorry. You know, so she's at the graveside and she's watching the family approach and like they're legitimately mourning him, but she doesn't have any legitimacy to mourn this man. She can't really be found at the graveside, you know. So, but she's not kind of, all she's sorry for is that she's lost this thing, this man, this love, mm-hmm. and that's all she can see because it was just so vibrant to her. So it's a very interesting dilemma, you know. And yeah. She does feel, and then there's a wonderful end. Oh my goodness. There's a great little twist at the end, which is super.
It sounds like you really, yeah. really are enjoying, I mean, you're rehearsing this,
nothing.
But you're really enjoying it and really enjoying getting yeah. to know Angie.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, when you do a one-woman piece, you know, there you have to really explore all in and out and around a character. And having done this was such a pleasure. Like, we did it, we developed it with the New Theatre. And they developed new material. They're in Temple Bar in Dublin. And they kind of really worked with us on the script and with Helen. And then Helen was really good at allowing Caroline and myself to kind of, you know, saying that just, I can't, it's not fitting in my mouth. And can we cut this or can we, you know, so to make it, and we're all the time trying to make it more clear. So what was a childhood memory? What was a fantasy? What actually happened? What does she think will happen in the future? You know, and how does she move on? She's now ready to move on.
Yeah, well, watch out all the men in the audience. Isn't that the case? All the married men in the audience better watch out,
well,
because Angie is...
It's a great, you know, it actually is one to bring your husband to. No, the men have enjoyed it, that have seen it, because it is beguiling, so... fair play to Helen Casey, it's terrific. But I love to see people afterwards. So if you hang about, give me 5 minutes to de-sweat and to get into real clothes and I'll come out. I love having the chats with people and to find out just what did you think, you know? What do you think happens next and all those questions.
Oh, fantastic. That's a rare enough opportunity to have that stage door experience with an actor.
Is it?
Yeah, well, it very often happens, I think, with, you know, with musicians who like to engage with audiences in that way after a performance. But, that stage door experience in the theatre is unusual, I'd say.
Well, I just think, I feel, you know, especially when you're touring, you know, you're driving home, especially with a one-woman piece, it's not half as much fun in the dressing room as when you're with a load of people. But it's just, you know, because you've left them with this dilemma. So it's just wonderful to talk to people and see. And you get stories. Oh, my goodness, you get great stories from people that, oh, I knew somebody and she had an affair with a man for a long time. And you get wonderful stories back, which is very inspiring.
So if you are inspired by the story of Angie, the vixen, and Rose Henderson, and if you're inspired by chatting to her afterwards, she will be in the Dunamace Theatre on the 14th of this month. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, it will be to hear from Andrew Hughes, the writer of Emma. Disappear.
Encore with Patters Bar, your award-winning bar, lounge and beer garden in Moat. Find Patters Bar Moat on Facebook or Instagram. Midlands
103. And you're welcome back to Encore. Emma Disappeared is the new novel by Andrew Hughes. He's an archivist, a writer, and when I was chatting to him recently, we started in the past about his previous novel, The Coroner's Daughter, and how it made Dublin come alive. Before we talk about the new book, the first thing I have to talk about is the One Dublin, One Book novel, which was The Coroner's Daughter. And I mentioned this in the context of the book club that I'm involved in myself. And it's really interesting how, you know, we move on through other books, but people keep coming back to that one and saying, yeah, but do you remember how he made the city come alive? Do you remember how Dublin was such a character in... In The Coroner's Daughter, apart from the, you know, the excitement of the story and the character herself, Abigail, but that is a thing that is really important to you, isn't it? That sense of the believable world that we can lose ourselves in.
Absolutely, and Dublin in particular. Yeah, I come from a history background, and then started doing archives. But one of the things that I always did was that I would offer to research house histories for people in Dublin, particularly the kind of the owners of Georgian houses in Dublin. So I would research the history of their houses, find out all the people who lived in a particular house, and find out what they got up to, put it together in a narrative, and then write it out. So I found that I was doing that quite a lot, and I had done a lot for Fitzwilliam Square in particular. And so my first book was actually a non-fiction book, a history book of Fitzwilliam Square in Dublin. So I was really comfortable in this 19th century Dublin world. And when it was time for me to move on from kind of writing history and into writing fiction, it just felt natural to kind of set my stories in 19th century Dublin. I had this perfect setting for stories. I had this ready-made cast of characters with all these people, interesting people that I'd come across in the course of my research. So Dublin, and particularly 19th century Dublin, was a huge kind of start for me. But then it's kind of moved on, you know, from Coroner's Daughter, now moving into the contemporary world. I found it was much the same. I kind of really enjoyed using the Dublin that I know now as the backdrop for my story, and, you know, Trinity College and the National Library, and even up around Drumcondra, where I lived at the time and where I lived for 20 years after college. Just Fagan's, the local pub, the Botanic Gardens that were close by. So it's just nice to use the Dublin I know for the novel, and Dublin has always been a great backdrop for my books.
And the idea of mystery clearly is important to you as well, whether it is in the absolute present or in more than 100 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was doing archives and historical research, I was always kind of drawn to the stories more than anything. Just the stories that kind of resonated and I found fascinating. And so my first novel was about a real life murderer, Dublin Castle informer called John Delahunt. So I'd come across that character in the course of my research. It seemed like the perfect story and the perfect character for historical fiction. And so I think then that just kind of naturally drew me into the crime world as kind of, you know, the genre that I would write novels in. And it was a case then after Delahunt of coming up with a new character and a story that wasn't based on reality at all, but something that I just made up. And I wanted to move away from Delahunt, who was the villain, and, you know, have the main character be the hero. I wanted a young woman rather than a young man. And so the idea of Abigail Lawless, the coroner's daughter, popped into my head. And so that was a pure kind of young lady sleuth in Regency Dublin, solving murders. That was very much a mystery. And then, yeah, so I think then I just kind of found myself in that crime genre. I think I just loved the stories.
Yeah.
And it seemed somehow it suited me. I don't know what that says about me, but and then, yeah, so moving into this contemporary crime, I said I'm still going to, contemporary stories, I'm still going to have crime as being my genre. And moved back into the head of a young male protagonist. And it's a question of, is he the villain? How much of a villain is he? Is he a victim of circumstance?
Yeah.
How much does he know about the disappearance of this young woman, Emma Hart, who's at the center of the story? Emma disappeared. Yeah, I think crime and mystery has always drawn me.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about Lister, because you and he have certain things in common, don't you?
I mean, that, you know, I can't deny that. he's an archivist in the National Library. I happen to be a professional archivist. He lives in Botanic Avenue. I happen to live in Botanic Avenue. I was writing the book. His local is Fagan's. His favorite drink is Hop House. But, you know, there the similarities end. And it was a case of when we get into the darker recesses of the mind, it's a case of making it up. So I've worked with archives and historical research and so on, and I found that it's taken me to really interesting places.
Mm.
I started off in the television archives in RTE, and I was shortlisting programs there, it's called. But I've gone to big country houses to survey archives there. I was 2 years ago, I was in Tullynally Castle in Westmeath.
Oh, what a fabulous place.
Oh, yeah. I was surveying the archives there for the Pakenham family. They even gave me a flat in the castle for the duration of my stay. That was really like living in the midst of some kind of BBC murder mystery.
And then sitting always down at the kitchen table, kitchen table to bread and jam and marmalade, and such an ordinary, such an ordinary welcome and such extraordinary setting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Now the Pakenhams were really lovely. They welcomed me in. Thomas and Valerie. Valerie sadly passed away. I think it was this time last year, or early last year, which is very sad. But they were so welcoming to me when I was there. Now there was ordinary. Every time I passed, I was working in the archives room, which is on the top floor of the castle. But I had to kind of pass the kitchen as I was on my way. Every time I passed, Valerie would just call out to me, "Would you like some cake?" So she was just so welcoming.
Take out the tin, yeah.
But then there was some candlelit soirees as well that I was invited to. Anyway, it's absolute inspiration for a possible big house murder mystery. Anyway, but I can't constantly be thinking along those lines. Basically, they were extremely welcoming, and it was a really interesting job. But it struck me that archives is an interesting line of work, or it can be. So I said, why not have Lister be an archivist and have him working in the National Library. So kind of, approaching modern Dublin, but with this kind of historical sense as well.
And somebody who knows lots about secrets because he spends time uncovering them, really.
He would. I mean, it's mostly the secrets that he's keeping are what's driving him.
Yeah.
Because as the novel starts, this Trinity College graduate, this young entrepreneur, Emma Hart, is missing. And, all of Dublin is talking about it. It's all across social media. It's all across, standard media.
Yeah.
And for some reason, James Lister, our protagonist, is showing undue interest in the case. And it's a question of, as the novel goes on, just how much does he know about what happened on the night Emma disappeared? And it could be that he knows more than he should. And we follow him as he is, just going about his middle-class life, going to a nice job. He's got his family. He's struck up a relationship with this another kind of Trinity College graduate student called Libby Miller. And so as he's just going about his normal life, is the net closing in because of what happened on the night that Emma disappeared?
Did you enjoy writing this, so different to take yourself, story is story in some ways, but taking yourself out of that world that you have immersed yourself in for so long, doing what all of us, having the opportunity to answer the question that all of us ask when we pass one of those lovely Georgian houses, is what was it like in there for people who live there? And you know that because yeah, you're digging into those archives, but to be right up front and centre, taking on the world as it is today, and you didn't go to the 80s or the 70s in the time before mobile phones,
yeah,
when life might have been a little bit easier for the crime writer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, that definitely crossed my mind as I was moving into the contemporary world. Would it be easier to get before social media and before mobile phones and have things a bit, because I went to Trinity in the 90s. Late 90s. So that would have, I could have told that story fairly easily from that point of view. But I said, look, if you're going to move into the contemporary world, move right up to date as much as possible. But actually, I found that there were opportunities, kind of story opportunities to be had from the use of mobile phones and social media and so on. And so why not, instead of just kind of worrying about it, just kind of embrace that and see what kind of stories you could tell. Like the very first scene, Lister is on his way to work and Libby Miller, who he doesn't know, she's just a stranger, sits down beside him and she opens up her laptop because she wants to do some work before she goes to college. And her name is displayed on the login page of her screen, just to log into Windows.
Yeah.
And so Lister is the type who sees her name, dips his hand into his pocket and just Googles her name just to see what comes up in her Twitter profile and Instagram and all sorts comes up. And so he just starts interacting with her. He kind of starts liking her tweets as she's sitting beside him. Just, this kind of creepy way to interact with this stranger. And she's kind of wondering, who is this who is this person who's liking my tweets? I've never come across him before, little knowing that he's actually sitting beside her. So it was kind of something like that, which can only be done with social media.
Yeah.
And what we can find out about people just by Googling their names. It's things like that that I could say, well, this is, you know, this is what you can do with a story that's right up to date. So let's just kind of explore those ideas and see what we can make of it.
Andrew Hughes is the author of Emma Disappeared, and you can get it in all good bookshops. We will be chatting about another book after the break, and this one is about making felt. Stay with us.
Encore with Patters Bar in Moat, with live music every weekend and all sports showing on our big screens. Find Patters Bar Moat on Facebook or Instagram. Midlands
103. How much do you know about Irish wool and felting? Well, if you're like me, not very much at all. But Annika Berglund does, and she is one of three people who has written about it. If you'd like to make and card your own felt, the book is available at feltmakersireland.com, and Annika has been telling me all about it.
Well, we started out just with the idea that we weren't really using Irish wool for felting to the extent that we wanted. And then we realised we didn't actually know enough about Irish wool and felting. So the project was to test different breeds of sheep reared in Ireland to see how they felted, because they all felt differently. So we ended up testing 40 breeds of wool from 40 breeds of sheep and testing them for how they felted. And that was meant to be the main part of the book. But then we realized it wasn't that easy to get wool washed and carded. So we decided to write about, if you wanted to wash and card it yourself, how do you do that? And because we started looking at that, we looked at dyeing wool. So we added a few chapters about that. Then we looked a little bit at, could you felt it without washing and carding it? And that had some promising avenues, but that's about where we left it. So half the book is about how to look after wool if you get it straight from a farmer, and the other half is about the different breeds and what kind of felting they lend themselves to.
Okay, so we're going to have two questions there that listeners will be curious about. First of all, is who is the we when you talk about we?
I am a member and on the committee for Feltmakers Ireland, which is a guild promoting felt making in Ireland.
And that leads me nicely to the second question, which is, what exactly is felt? Because it's more than what we see lining a snooker table. There's a very particular kind of felt that you're thinking about. So you might explain to us what that is.
Absolutely. It's actually a kind of magic, because it's a fabric that is made without weaving, knitting or crocheting. And it's probably the oldest fabric made. And basically you take wool and you rub it. And you can either, the easiest is with soap and water, and you rub it and you take this fluffy, tufty wool and it turns into a fabric like magic.
And with that fabric, then you can make all of the beautiful things that we see in the very expensive Irish design shops. Sometimes the scarves and the hats and the bits and pieces.
It can make a flat fabric, or it can make objects if you, so it can work in 3D in relief. And because you can dye it, you can have all sorts of beautiful colours. And when you layer different colours and then felt them together, you get very amazing depth of colour and nuances that you kind of didn't know when you started out you were going to get.
What gave you an interest in wool and in felting in particular, and becoming then a member of the Feltmakers Guild of Ireland?
Actually, I started out in a completely different field. I'm a sculptor. I mainly worked in ceramics and then some glass and bronze. But coming up to 2019, I was worried about the energy consumption of those art forms, and that, I'd been in an exhibition about global warming, and the energy I used making stuff for that exhibition could probably have energized a small village. So I was looking for something new, and I looked at different textile and mixed media options, and felt just ended up being the most promising and the most interesting for me.
And it's a very tactile experience then, I'm guessing, if you're starting with wool and creating your old felt, as it sounds like you do.
You can work small or you can work big. Now, I like to work big, and with felt that can be a little difficult, because if you lay it out flat, it usually starts at least 150% bigger than the final result. So if you want to make something a meter square, you have to lay out a meter and a half.
Okay,
to
for shrinkage.
1 meter at 80. So smaller things are easier, but it is an amazing material, and it's also a lot more sustainable than many other things you can work with.
Well, just now that you mentioned the sustainability of it, if you happen to be a sheep farmer in Ireland, and you know we'll come to May and June soon when farmers across the Midlands will be shearing their sheep, and they will have bags and bags and bags of wool that they will get, if they're lucky, they'll get the price of the shearing for. There is no value on wool anymore as a product. It's almost like a waste product in some years. It's effectively a waste product because, it costs more to produce it and dispose of it than you get for it.
Yes, definitely. And the emphasis of Irish agricultural policy has been on meat, not wool. So in some respects, the meat quality the meat quality has gone up, and the wool quality may not have stayed as fine, or could have deteriorated because it wasn't an emphasis.
We're sheep farmers ourselves. The big issue is that there used to be a very big Chinese market for wool. There's very little Irish wool from sheep that becomes wool for knitting or wool that's used in the country. A lot of it used to go to China, and the Chinese market disappeared, and there just isn't enough of a market in Ireland to support the production that's even there at the moment.
Yes, and there are so many ways it could be used. Like, there's no insulation better, and it has so many amazing properties, but that takes an infrastructure to look after the wool, to get it washed and carded, or get it treated so you can have it for insulation. There are some movements afoot. There is a new wool council, but it's all very slow. And I know many farmers are very impatient. We got great response from farmers when we went out looking for wool for the book. Many of them gifted the wool for the project. But again, the big problem was to get it washed and carded.
And in your research... I was going to ask you, in your research, did you discover that you don't need to wash it and card it to use it for felting?
Well, in some ways, if you're not too concerned about a very smooth, even felt, since you're using water and soap anyway, to some degree you can wash out the lanolin if the wool itself is very clean to start with. But because that will be kind of the more natural locks of the wool, it'll be a lump, kind of a bumpier wool. Mm-hmm. But that can have its kind of good sides if what you're looking for doesn't have to be super flat and even.
It sounds like it's been a real labour of love for you and all the members of the guild.
Yes. I mean, we did 4 different samples with each breed of sheep, and we tried to get more than one person to do each breed. And that was a lot of work because the local Irish wool is a little harder to felt than some of the fine, soft imported wool.
The merinos and things,
There are pros and cons. You may not want most Irish wool for stuff that you wear kind of very close to your skin. But for bags and coats and rugs, it's perfect because it's strong and sturdy. And there are some of the native wools that are also very soft and can be used for most things.
Well, as we're talking here, the farming programme is being broadcast in the other studio. So I'm hoping there'll be a little crossover here and somebody will be listening in all the many sheep farmers in the region here. Annika, thank you so much for talking to us. I really appreciate you giving your time this evening and your enthusiasm as well, indeed.
Well, thank you very much. We really enjoyed making the book and meeting the farmers. And
And that is Annika Berglund. The website is feltmakersireland.com and the book itself is called Exploring Irish Feltmaking. And you can get it on the website. And that is it from me for this evening. What a fast programme, that hour just flew. I'll be back next week. I will be chatting to the director and the writer of the Reincarnation. Is it the Reincarnation? I don't have it in front of me now, but it's the play that the Tads are running in Tullamore next week, and it's really interesting. I had the guys in last week in studio, and it just sounds like it's going to be a whole lot of fun. And we'll be coming back also to the Eurovision. Joe Cooney, I think, is up after the news. I know there's somebody knocking around there. I'll be back with you next week. Till then, take care of yourself. Good night.
Encore, with thanks to the Cellar Bistro, Strand Street, Athlone. Newly refurbished and open Thursday to Sunday. Find the Cellar Bistro on Facebook. Midlands 1.